Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Pastor Bob Thune from Coromandel Church. I'm here with Pastor Dusty White. Wait, he's here?
He's back!
Yep.
And Pastor Chris Ellman for City Church. On Wednesdays, we sit down and talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. Today, we're talking about Chris's trip to the other side of the world.
I kind of feel like these podcasts are turning into my travelogue.
I kind of
talk about your world adventures.
Since you're going all over the world, that's kind of, I mean, Dusty and I just hang out here.
Yeah.
Dusty went to
I did go to Iowa recently. I went to Lincoln in Iowa, you know, not too far.
Although Dusty, you haven't been on this podcast in like 12 episodes.
Thanks for having me. I feel like a special guest.
You're so welcome to the podcast. Chris, when we, two episodes ago, you were getting ready to leave for Nepal.
Yeah.
And we talked a little bit about that. And then now you're back.
Made it. So made it around the world.
You have been around the world, and we want to know about your time. What did you we want to know. I guess I want to know. I hope our listeners want to know too. I mean, hey, I said this last time, but Nepal's not a place a whole lot of us go.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know just sort of what you experienced there, both sort of religiously, spiritually, culturally. I know you sent me some photos that were interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
You ran into some interesting things. You ran into some guys from Iowa on the other side of the world. So,
yeah. So, you know, it was funny about that, the connection, because Eric Goodell, our worship leader, he went with me and he had talked about his cousin. They support a guy who was doing theological education in Kathmandu. And I was like, Bob was telling me about a guy they support that does theological education in Kathmandu. How many guys from Iowa could be in Nepal doing theological education at a Reform seminary? It's got to be the same
guy.
Same guy. So yeah, it was fun to get breakfast with Philip. He's doing some good work there.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What took you there? Like what, why'd you go?
Yeah. So we went over there to work with an organization called Church in Hard Places. We started a partnership with them at the beginning of this year, and they do training for pastors and church planners. And so they used to be under the umbrella of Acts 29. Now they're under the umbrella of Practical Shepherding. And so, yeah, we were over there to spend some time with pastors and church planners and do some training with them. And so it was an incredible experience on a number of levels. I'm still kind of processing all that I experienced over there.
Sure.
Where would be a good place to start for you to bring us into the journey?
Yeah. So I think the first is just the experience of a different culture. I had never been outside a Western context before. So this was the first time being in an Asian context, being in a developing country. So they're technically third world, although they're probably on the higher end of what you would call third world. And so just the experience of being in a big city that doesn't have the same order and infrastructure that we have. And that was probably one of the first things when we this huge contrast. So we had a 10-hour layover in Doha, Qatar, and we left the airport. One of the guys in our church who's in the military stationed there, he came and got us, and we drove around. And Doha, Qatar is like one of the most modern cities you will ever see. It is clean. It is all high tech. It is this very manicured, curated place for tourists to come. And so you feel like you're just in like the state of the art world. You go from there to Kathmandu, Nepal, and it's just a different experience. It is big. It's crowded. It's full of life and adventure. And you're just kind of overwhelmed at first. That was the first thing. Like, this is just super overwhelming because, so the way we describe it is this. Imagine walking in like a big crowd. You know how if you're like at a ball game or maybe you're at Disney World or someplace, and how people navigate a crowd. There's no like person directing traffic. You're just kind of on your own, but people kind of just navigate space and you kind of have these unspoken, hey, I'm going to go this way. You go this way. Now imagine everybody's in a car. Like that's how they drive. It is just this organized chaos, this dance. And so we were talking to people, some of the Nepali pastors about that. And they said, yes, it's a communal experience. People are just kind of moving around. There's no stoplights. There's no stop signs. Once in a while, you'll have some people like an officer directing traffic in a few spots. And people are like honking their horns at each other, but it's not angry honking. No one's angry. Everyone is just, hey, I'm here. Hey, I'm here. Just watch out for me. It's the way they communicate. And I'm like, if this was America, we would be cussing and screaming and fighting. And yet they just kind of do it and they make it work. But the first time we got into a cab driving through the city, Eric and I's eyes were just like, oh, like, what is happening to us right now? Because this feels like just crazy chaos. But they make it work. No accidents. And so it became kind of this fun little adventure. Anytime we would go from one place to the next, but when you're walking around, you have to keep your head on a swivel because it's just motorcycles, mopeds, cars, people, like just constantly. And there's very little room to kind of navigate. So just the overwhelming experience when we first got there. But the thing that was, that really struck us immediately is the people in Nepal are so kind. Like they just, they don't live their life in a hurry. There's not an aggression. It's just a very different contrast to living, being in a big city in the United States. And so we really enjoy just spending time with the Nepali people, both the Christians there and then some of the folks that weren't Christian that we got to meet there and spend some time with. And being two, you know, 6'1" white dudes walking around in Nepal, we drew a lot of attention. The first day we were there, we were visiting this, it was a former palace of a ruler in Nepal, kind of in the history. And it was kind of intermingled with some Hindu temples. And we got bum rushed by these boarding school kids. Probably 20, 25 kids came up and just started asking us all these questions. And they learned English over there. So the English was really good. And just were fascinated that we were from the United States. And so that was pretty fun.
Yeah. Tell us what the religious or spiritual landscape of Nepal is like.
Yeah, that was probably one of the more striking things. So it's a predominantly Hindu country. And it is a... The religion is intermixed in the culture in ways that we have lost touch with in the West. So, I mean, there was a time where Christianity and our culture were so intermingled where it felt like everything we did kind of had, every kind of cultural practice had some tinge of Christian meaning to it. And it's the same way there. So to give you an example, the way that they greet each other, they say namaste, and they kind of do a short little bow. That means the God in me greets the God in you. Like that's just their normal, that's like us saying hi. Mm. It is shot through with religious significance. So what the Christians do is they have their own greeting. They say jamase, which means praise Jesus. Mm. So the way you greet people in that culture has religious significance, whether you're Hindu or whether you're Christian. So just the intermingling of that, we were there. We happened to be there. There's a 3-day celebration of Krishna, his birthday. So this is like the Christmas of the Hindu religion. So Krishna is one of their prominent gods. And so we were there during these big festivals and we got to observe just the practice of this. And so if you can imagine just seeing people dressed up, very traditional dress, faces painted, masks, costumes, various things to all celebrate the birth of Krishna and just kind of standing in the middle of these crowds and just observing this. It was pretty significant just in the sense of, man, I've never seen anything like this. I've never seen this large of an open practice of a religion other than Christianity. And we got to visit a number of Hindu temples, a number of Buddhist temples, and seeing people practice. There's two things that were really interesting. One, we almost got to see a living goddess. So there is, yeah, this is, so within, and I don't quite understand all the connection here, but there is this, within the Hindu religion and in Nepal, there is this young girl under 9 years old who is the reincarnation of Shiva. I can't remember exactly, but they believe that she is a reincarnation of a goddess. She's kind of inhabited by this goddess, but she's only inhabited up until the age of like 9 or 10. And so it's this thing, young girl, comes out and you can like see her only certain times of year. And because it was Krishna's birthday, she was out. So we saw this sign kind of in this temple, living goddess, and we're like, what is that? And so we kind of walk over to see it, and this guy kind of looks out the window, and we're like, so what is this? And he goes, it's the living goddess. Like, okay. And so he's like, come back after 3, and you can actually just come up and see her. And she's like, in this little room. And so Eric and I kind of, we leave and go see some other things. We're like, should we go back and do that? We kind of felt like, is that something we should do? We didn't end up doing it, but we were kind of tempted to do that. So that kind of thing where they literally believe that there is a living goddess that you can come and just observe. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty interesting. The probably the most significant thing that we saw that was still kind of blows my mind is we visited one of the major Hindu temples there where they do the cremation. And so you go down and this is where they bring their dead. They do this ritual in the river that kind of runs through the city that they believe is sacred. And then they will set the body on a platform and light it on fire. And so you go down and there's probably 5 or 6 platforms and each one of them had fires going and they had bodies in them. And so to watch, which is essentially like, whoa, a funeral happening.
Whoa.
Open air burning of bodies was, man, that's still to this today, I'm still processing like the spiritual kind of darkness and also just the curiosity of that. But what's interesting too is it's a tourist, like it's a World Heritage site. So it's set up as a tourist spot. So if you can imagine like opening your funeral to tourists. So it felt a little weird too. Like, should we be here taking pictures and taking videos? But it wasn't discouraged. But to see a completely different religion practiced like that and kind of the dark piece of that right there out in the open. When we were there, we saw they were doing the funeral of this. She probably looked maybe like in her 20s. She looked young, and they had her body wrapped in kind of the funeral garment. They were down there washing her feet. They washed her feet, and they pour water in her mouth. So there's this whole ceremony. And then we watched them take her over to the platform and kind of cover her with wood. And we kind of saw her feet sticking out of the pile, and then her body went on fire. So,
whoa.
Yeah, it was something else, man.
Is this the part where we say, hey, at the beginning of this episode, if you're listening in the car.
Yeah.
And
sorry about that. Yeah.
Turn this part down. It's a little disturbing.
Yeah. So saw the integration of their religion with their culture. And the way that the city's even built up, because you know there's not a lot of like development plan. It just feels like the city was just kind of built hodgepodge. So you'll just be walking through these neighborhoods, and then boom, there's a temple, and then there's a couple of like squares that are bigger. We have the bigger temples that have a little bit more organization around them. But it just imagine walking through a neighborhood, and just boom, there's a temple. There's a place for worship, and just such an integration of the culture with their religion. And yeah, I think it's, you know, 80-some% are Hindu. The next largest number are Buddhist. Depending on the numbers, it's anywhere from 1.5 to 2% Christian.
What does the work of the gospel look like there? How do people think about evangelism in that context?
Yeah, so Nepal is technically a closed country in the sense of, closed is probably not the right term. You can practice Christianity. You can't evangelize. You can't openly. It's against the law. Five years in prison. $500 fine if you openly proselytize. It's also against the law to convert to Christianity there. But what's interesting talking with the pastors is it's not like an aggressive hostility. So unless you are kind of doing the street preacher thing, you're really the church isn't. They're not actively coming after churches, trying to close churches down. So you can evangelize like relationally, like if you're sharing the gospel with a friend, coworker, if you're kind of doing it one-on-one, then that, you know, you're not going to really get in trouble unless the person you're sharing the gospel with wants to go after you like aggressively. So it's this weird kind of mix of, hey, what you're doing is illegal, but at the same time you can practice and you're not like, there's not active persecution. So a lot of the work of the gospel is it's highly relational. And these pastors, pretty much everyone we talked to grew up a Hindu. One guy, his dad, and still is, Hindu priest and witch doctor. So he's telling stories of like the rituals that his dad still does, that people come to him to like cast spells or remove spells and different things like that. And each one of these guys, yeah, someone come up and just a friend shared the gospel or a classmate shared the gospel with me and just kind of stirred their curiosity. And then from there, you know, the Lord just went to work on their heart. So it's a lot of on the ground, slow relational work. I mean, a big church there. I mean, if you're a church of 40 or 50, you're big. So it's slow work.
And my understanding is the Christianity that is in Nepal is pretty flimsy, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So the predominant sort of flavor is, prosperity gospel. Right. Yeah. So one of the work that Church in Hard Places is trying to do is trying to develop pastors in good gospel centered, just understanding of philosophy of ministry. So a pretty cool story. One of the guys, so there are four Acts 29 churches in Nepal. It's more than the state of Nebraska now.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
So anyway, one of the guys, he is actually in an Assembly of God church and still is. And he knew that, so the guy who oversees Acts 29 in Nepal, they were old Bible college friends. And so they reconnect. And so he's starting to, his friend, the Acts 29 guy, is just trying to develop him in good gospel centered resources, kind of develops him theologically. And then over the period of about a year and a half to 2 years, he flips his church. And one of the things that he said is like the biggest way that this has impacted my pastoring is how I preach. He's like, I used to just get up and kind of just, the Holy Spirit's giving me a word and just wing it. And now he actually sits down, goes through, develops expository sermons, preaching through books of the Bible. And so what Church in Hard Places is trying to do is develop a core of pastors who are grounded, rooted in good theology, good preaching, good ecclesiology, and then, hey, develop other pastors. And so in what you're starting to see is the growth of that work. And so we were working with a cohort of 12 guys, and these guys are already developing their next church planter. And so, Lord willing, over the next several years, you're going to see a multiplication, not only of just Christians and churches, but healthy, good, grounded, gospel-centered churches. And they're hoping that that will sort of change the nature of Christianity in Nepal.
What was the best thing you ate in Nepal?
Whoa, that was a turn.
That was a turn. So the best thing that I ate on the entire trip was actually in Doha.
Nope,
so,
that's not what I asked.
But, what's
the
okay.
best thing? We'll do that question later.
Yeah. So two things that probably a tie. So we ate momos, which are kind of the dumpling of in Nepal. Some really good momos. And then we ate some Nuwari food. So the Nuwari people are the indigenous people to Nepal. And they have, it's not significantly different than kind of your traditional Nepalese food, but it has a few different flavors and it's rather spicy compared to the rest of the Nepalese food, I guess. And so we ate at this little Nuwari restaurant, which it felt like you walked into someone's kitchen, ordered in the kitchen, and then walked upstairs and sat in their living room. And so it was a really cool experience. But it was the food was kind of this fried, almost like a pancake, kind of a savory pancake with an egg in it, and then some potatoes. And then we also ate, I can't remember the name of it, but they were almost like a sweet momo. But they only make them on special occasions. And so they made them because it was Krishna's birthday. And so the fact that we got to eat these was kind of a special thing. So all of those things were really good.
Okay, now what'd you have in Doha?
Hey, real quick, fun fact. I had momos here in Omaha.
They do have them.
With our Nepalese family.
Yeah, yeah.
When we had a guy in our church from Nepal die. And because he died, they brought out the momos at the home. And it was a big ordeal.
And because you can't get beef in a lot of places because of the Hindu religion, you usually get chicken or buffalo there. And you can get them either steamed, fried, or there's this other term that's kind of for grilled. And so we got some steamed and some grilled ones. They were very good, very good. But the best meal, we went to a Lebanese restaurant in Doha. And so it was like this whole big, all-you-can-eat, basically, you know, Mediterranean tapas kind of stuff. And so after a 14-hour flight, it hit the spot.
Sounds delicious. What were you, now I'm going to switch gears.
Why didn't you bring any of that for our snack for today?
By the way, rebuke to all listeners, there are no snacks today.
And our snacks are Ricola cough drops. There's a pile of cough drops.
Listeners have all dishonored us and failed at their responsibilities.
You can't shame people into generosity.
I know, but I can't.
But we can try.
Chris, what did you come away most encouraged by that the Spirit of God is doing?
I was super encouraged by the pastors that we worked with. A lot of these guys are younger, probably in their early 30s, super, super hungry to grow. And to see the camaraderie among this group of pastors. So the Narayan, the cohort leader, the Acts 29 guy there, his name is Narayan. He's in his late 30s, and you can really tell he's like the older brother to these pastors. And just to see the rapport, there was a love and affection. They joked around like brothers, but they were super encouraging to each other. So you can just see a unity among that group of like-minded pastors and a love for one another and encouragement for one another. So whenever you see just pastors not competing, not trying to one-up each other, but just to see, hey, we love each other, we're for each other, we're doing the same work, we want to see the gospel go forward. I really was encouraged by that. Also just encouraged by the boldness of these guys. Like one of the pastors, he talked about when he first planted his church, he got a little wrapped around the axle about the fact that it was illegal. And now when this guy converted, his family literally beat him up. So, you know, he was probably a little gun shy in some ways. But he said the first year of his church, he wasn't as bold in sharing the gospel. And he had like one or two people. And the Lord really convicted him. It's like, no, I've called you to do this work. And so go and share the gospel. And so he just was like, all right, I'm going to do it. I'm going to trust the Lord. And within a year, his church had grown to like 40 people, which is, you know, it's a pretty significant growth curve for there. So to see these guys boldly sharing the gospel in a culture that is, there's risk to it. Again, it's not like other places. There are some places where there's a bigger risk, but there's still a risk in which different than what we experience here in the U.S. And so it was very convicting to me to see, man, these guys, well, they really could get in trouble with the law. They really could. There really is a consequence. So another interesting thing is, so the churches can't own property there. And so if you're a church and you want to actually own a property, like your pastor has to be the one to own. It has to be like in his name. And so these guys are putting like their financial security and their financial, you know, their credit line and all that stuff, as it's understood there, on the line to plant churches and to lead a body of believers. And so to see the risk these guys take is pretty encouraging. Makes me realize, you know, we have it good, and that's a blessing, but also kind of provoking to think, hey, how can I be more bold and take some risk in some ways? I also was encouraged by seeing the hunger these guys have for good theology, good ecclesiology, a desire to, they really were locked in. Like, I want to preach expository sermons. I want to plant a healthy church. I want to have a good ecclesiology. I want to be a healthy leader myself. So these guys were just really embracing all the things that you would want a pastor to embrace. And I really do believe if the work that Church in Hard Places is doing there, if they continue to do that work, that I think that the water level for Christianity in Nepal, what is the predominant influence of Christianity in Nepal, is going to change within the next 25 years.
That's encouraging.
What did it do to you? Like, what moved in your soul beyond some of that camaraderie, brotherhood stuff that you saw and that those guys are putting it on the line? Was there anything the Lord did in your own like soul that you were like, this changed me?
Yeah, I don't know if there was any like overly transformative experience other than very encouraged and kind of provoked in the things that I feel a burden for. So to see these guys giving themselves to raising up new leaders, like I have a burden for that, and it was provoking. It's like, yeah, that's work that I want to do. These guys encourage me in that work.
Confirming.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think just the encouragement of being around these guys and seeing the work that they're doing in their context was provoking for me to come back and say, you know what, I want to commit to this too. You guys put wind in my sails to say, okay, let's continue to double down on this. And I'm always going to be encouraged by guys who are trying to do the same work with less resources. It's like, if they can do this work with the resources they have, how much more should we be able to continue that work with the resources that God has blessed us with?
Mm-hmm. Are the pastors you encountered there bivocational, or are their churches tithing and they're funding their pastor's salary through the gifts of the church?
A lot of them are, that's like their primary job. Good. So their church is able to, they're able to do that full time. But there were a few guys that were bivocational, but were hoping to transition into full time.
Are all the pastors you met working in and around Kathmandu?
Yes, the ones that we met. The hope is that for Church in Our Places is that the next round of pastors, they're kind of expanding out into the villages around the city. So starting in that city and then kind of expanding out.
Did you guys try to climb any mountains or anything like that?
No, we stayed in the city. We stayed safely in the city. There was one day where we were going to try to take a cable car up to an area where if it's clear, you can see Everest from there.
Ew.
But it's the tail end of the rainy season, so it's still pretty cloudy most days, and so you couldn't see it. But that would have been kind of cool. I mean, it's like 125 miles. The base camp's about 125 miles or so, 150 miles, and so you're not right there at the foot of Everest, but on a clear day you can see it.
That's cool. Well, Chris, thanks for going to the other side of the world to serve the purposes of the Church of Jesus Christ. And thanks for telling us a little bit about what you experienced.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity. It definitely was it was an incredible experience. It was everything that I was hoping it would be, and I'm really excited to see for myself and for First City Church just a growing partnership with the pastors in Nepal, and hopefully we can continue to be an encouragement to them.
If listeners were we're going to pray one specific thing for the work of God in Kathmandu, what should they ask God for?
Yeah, I would say protection for that core group of pastors. Those guys are laying the groundwork for what is hopefully not just the conversion of many souls, but the health of the church in Nepal. And like I said, there are a lot of young guys. And so the hope is that they're going to be doing good gospel work for the decades to come, and that the impact that will have over time will be significant.
Well, as we always say, the goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, thanks for listening in. Pray this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. You're always welcome to reach out to us, podcast@cdomaha.com, with thoughts, questions, or future podcast topics. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.